Lord, open our hearts, our minds, our lives to your word. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So, my childhood has been shaped by war and conflict. In fact, if it wasn't for international conflict, or at least the threat of international conflict, I probably wouldn't exist. See, the only way a scruffy bloke from Blackpool can meet an exotic woman from Malta was to join the army and be posted out to that island in the middle of the Mediterranean. So, actually, the only reason I'm here is because of conflict and war. Because that's what kind of made my mum and dad get together. Or at least the threat of conflict and war. So back in the late 60s, Malta, the Mediterranean, that permanent Mediterranean battleship, was there because as a strategic place for the British Navy because of Valletta Harbour. And because the British Navy were there, the British Army were there to support what the Navy were doing. It was a place where we could keep an eye on what was going on in the Mediterranean, in North Africa, in the Middle East. And then after that, we went as a family in the early 70s to Northern Ireland. The only reason we went to Northern Ireland is because my dad was in the forces. My early childhood was shaped by conflict and war. We were there because of the troubles that were happening at the time. I remember one of my earliest memories is of living in a married quarters. The married quarters, the thing that I remember most was this huge barbed wire fence. It was probably not much shorter than the top of the gallery shelf there. And on top of that were rolls of barbed wire, and that surrounded the whole of the married quarters and the barracks and the nursery and the school. We were all here inside that. And as well as the fence, the other thing I remember were the Alsatian dogs. So on our side of the fence, about 5 metres from the fence, were Alsatian dogs on long runners, 200 metre long runners, that would run along the fence. And at one end of the runners, they would have a sort of dog shelter to take shelter in, but often they would be there. So my life and some of the early images I have of my life were shaped by conflict and war. And then in the early 80s, we were posted to Cyprus, which was actually a flipping fantastic 2.5 years. Because school finished in the summer, school finished at 12 o'clock, and in the winter it finished at 12:30. So either by 12:15 or 12:45, we were in the sea. Because we were living in Akateri, so the sea was right next to us. But also, we were right next to the RAF base. So I have real distinct memories of walking to school, and early in the morning, because school might have finished at 12, but it started early. Early in the morning, Chinook helicopters would be flying over to the Lebanon to keep the peace with the UN peacekeeping force that were there. And we knew where they were going. They were headed to the Lebanon. And sometimes we'd occasionally see flying into Akateri, only rarely see, but occasionally see, along with all the squadrons of Phantom jets, we'd occasionally see a US Blackbird spy plane that would be doing sorties around that part of the Middle East and North Africa, keeping its eye on Iraq and Iran and Syria and Lebanon and Libya. And then as a child, we had three different times when I was posted to Germany. The last time in my late teens, in the mid-80s, it was just before the wall came down, the Berlin Wall came down. And the perceived threat there, this was the middle of the Cold War, the perceived threat there was the bear, Russia. That's why we were posted out there. We were in a place called Senelager, which is massive infantry and artillery training out, huge. There's more soldiers in Senelager than anywhere else in the world, including England. It was just a huge, huge place. And we, as teenagers, we used to call it Senelager, probably the worst lager in the world. But it wasn't that bad. But there was another threat there, because actually the IRA were active on mainland Europe against army families and soldiers at the time that we were there. So one of my roles as a teenager was to... My dad had a really horrible brown, really hideous brown Leyland Maxi. The most unsexy car ever invented was the Leyland Maxi. Google it, look it up on a website, it's horrible. My dad had one, a new one. And it was, we used to go out in the morning and check the wheel arches. We would check the wheel arches for our dads in the morning before going to school. Our school run from Senilaga to Guttersloh, we were schooled in Guttersloh, was a 45-minute run. All school buses, 40 school buses, were exactly the same. They were big white buses, and they were very easy targets. And as we came into Guttersloh camp, I'd see those Alsatians again. There'd be two Alsatians and four MEPs, military police, MEPs, not members of the European Parliament, MPs, military police. And they would search the vehicle on the outside. So they would check the wheel arches. They'd also have a device that they would push underneath the vehicle that had a mirror on it so they could see before we were allowed onto camp. There was one time when the teachers at the school I was at, the second school I was at in Guttersloh, lived on a particular estate, and there had been a warning that there was an IRA unit that had been active in Gibraltar, and that they had they'd been seen to move into Germany. And one of my teachers actually spotted the unit on their housing estate, and either rather stupidly or bravely chased them off the housing estate. Coupled with sort of that childhood, I don't know if you, those of you that remember from the kind of mid-late 80s, just the sort of sense of what some of the culture was like. I don't know if anybody remembers seeing Fred's on BBC. It was a TV series where they took the scenario of planting a one-ton atomic bomb into the centre of Sheffield, and they showed very graphically the impact of a one-ton atomic bomb hitting the centre of Sheffield. And there was nothing left unseen in the imagery that they showed of that TV series. And then there was also Raymond Briggs wrote a book which was turned into a film called When the Wind Blows. Do you remember that film? And that two lovely elderly couple? And the premise to the book is that Russian-Afghanistan conflict that was happening in the mid-80s, some of the stuff that the Chinook helicopters from Cyprus were going out to check, that had all gone horribly long, and it had gone to nuclear war. And what you see in that book and then see in the film, in an animation which is beautifully made, is this elderly couple in their sort of 70s, 80s trying to go through the Protect and Survive pamphlet. A threefold little pamphlet that everybody got, Protect and Survive, and just the old man watching his wife hair fall out and die after weeks. Just that was kind of like part of what it was like in the 80s. And then there was another conflict that was going on in our house that went on throughout the whole of that, and probably the conflict that had the biggest impact upon my life, and that was the conflict that was going on between my mum and my dad. And just the reality of that as part of my childhood and shaped who I was. And then things started to get a little better, or at least it seems like humanity had got a bit sick to death of hatred and war and conflict. And there seemed to be an era of change and of hope and of sharing of common humanity. The Berlin Wall came down yesterday. We celebrated 30 years of the Berlin Wall coming down. Mikhail Gorbachev seemed like a really nice bloke, didn't he? Perestroika, Glasnost. The Cold War seemed to be coming to an end. My mum and dad got a divorce, and life for my mum and us got a bit more bearable and a bit more easy. That same year as the war came down. In 1994, we saw the end of apartheid in South Africa. And all that racial hatred seemed to come to an end. And Nelson Mandela, in prison for all those years, released. And then in 1998, we had what seemed like an intractable dispute seemed to come to an end with the Good Friday Peace Agreement in Northern Ireland. And for a while, there was even a moment where the most intractable of conflicts, the one between Palestine and Israel, the one that dictates so much of what goes on in the Middle East, even that, for a while, almost looked like it was going to come to an end. Never before and never since has what happened in 1993 happened, when the two leaders, Yasser Arafat, and I can't remember the guy who was the Israeli leader at the time, in 1993, outside the White House, shook hands. Never before and never since has that happened. And there's a famous and well-regarded, or he was well-regarded up to a point, political scientist, an American-Japanese bloke called Francis Fukuyama, and he recognised that things were becoming more peaceful, that democracy seemed to be rolling out, that there seemed to be a bit more of a liberalisation. And he also recognised that history is largely defined by wars and conflicts. And he said these words that didn't turn out to be true. He said, "We are witnessing the end of history." But he was wrong. Actually, we live in a time now that could never be more interesting from a historic point of view, unfortunately. Because humans are still humans, and our lives are still shaped by war and conflict, and many good and wonderful and beautiful things as well, but also by war and conflict, both international, national, and in our own personal lives. Look at Russia, America, Europe, the Middle East, North Korea, Turkey, the list is endless. And as Steve said earlier, there are soldiers from the British Army, from the United Nations, from around the world, peacekeeping forces in many, many countries, still today, still on active duty. And then if you look closer to home and we see the conflict that is caused by differences in politics, differences about Brexit, differences about climate change. And then if we look even closer to home, in our own lives and in our own homes, in our own relationships, we recognise there are still there signs of conflict and animosity. And into the middle of this history, into the middle of this reality, comes Jesus Christ, Son of God, God made man, and he says these bonkers words. I mean, they're bonkers. Love one another. As I have loved you, love one another. And Jesus wasn't saying this during the optimistic 90s, okay? He was saying this 2,000 years ago when Israel was occupied and oppressed. He wasn't saying this in comfortable surroundings. He knew the reality of what life was like. He knew it more than most, more than all. And he said, "You are my friend. You are my friend if you do as I command, love one another." Earlier in John 13, he describes this as a new commandment. "This a new commandment I give to you, my followers, that you love one another." But here he says something different. Those followers are now, he calls, his friends. And that is just stunning. You and I are his friends, are the friends of God. If you go to the Old Testament, Abraham is called a friend of God. Moses is sort of called a friend of God. And here is Jesus extending to all of us, saying it to all of us, that we are friends of God's. Jesus says to his friends, "Love one another." But is it realistic? I've just gone through that short history of some of my life. Is it realistic? Is it that easy? Is it that possible? Can it be done? So I was on holiday last week with the family, and I actually got round to reading a book, which doesn't happen that often these days. I once convinced Anna that I was a really interesting person to read to, and that I read a lot of books, and I think it was on that basis that she married me. And it turns out that I don't read quite so many. Here we go. It's called Benediction. It's by Kent Harriff, and it is based in Colorado, but it's based in a fictitious county called Holt. He's written a series of three. The benediction in this story is beautiful. It is the benediction of a mother and an elderly daughter looking after the husband, the dad, who's been diagnosed with bowel cancer and has a couple of months to live. And their benediction is their treatment and care of him, both the practical treatment, washing him and cleaning him. And it's just a beautiful, slow story of their benediction, their blessing, their love of their dad, their husband. And there's a side story in here that happens. There's a guy called Lyle. He's the local vicar. He's just moved in from the city to come into the town. And he reads a passage from the Bible that is very similar to this. This book, I can't identify exactly when the set. It's completely fictitious, by the way. I can't exactly identify the setting of it. But I think it's just at the start of the first Iraq war. Can I read you a chunk of this? It's a reasonably big chunk of it, but yeah. The text was from Luke. So this is Lyle in church preaching on a Sunday. But I tell you here, I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you and pray for those who mistreat you. If anyone hits you on one cheek, let him hit the other one too. If someone takes your coat, let him take your shirt as well. If you love only the people who love you, why should you receive a blessing? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those that only do good to you, why should you receive a blessing? He went on reading and came to the end of the text. Love your enemies and do good to them, and expect nothing back. You will then have a great reward, and you will be sons and daughters of the Most High God. For he is good to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Then he stopped and stood quietly and looked out at the congregation. The sanctuary was hot. The windows were open, but it was a hot day and hot inside. Women fanned their faces with a church bulletin. A car drove by in the street. There was birdsong from a nearby tree. He turned and set the Bible on the pulpit. Then he began to talk. This passage, he said, is usually referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. Augustine called it that first. It appears in both the Gospel of Matthew and Luke, but the texts are different somewhat. Matthew's is over 100 verses long. Luke is only some 30 verses long. Matthew says Jesus sat and spoke to the multitude and his disciples from a hill, from a mount. The writer of the Gospel of Luke tells us that Jesus stood on a level place and spoke from there. Both Gospels begin with the Beatitudes, the blessings. In Matthew, there are 9, and in Luke, there are 4. But the most important of these Bible texts say exactly the same thing. These are the ones that I have just read now, the crux of the matter for us, the soul of our lesson and the very essence of the teaching of Jesus. Love your enemies. Pray for those who harm you. Turn the other cheek. Give away money and don't expect it back. But what is Jesus talking about? He can't mean this literally. That would be impossible. He must have been speaking of some utopian idea, a fantasy. He must have been using a metaphor, suggesting a sweet dream. Because for all of us here, we know better. We're awake to the reality and know the world wouldn't permit such a thing. Never has and never will. We can be clear about that right now. Because here we are at war again. And we know the inescapable images and violence so well. We've seen them all too often. The naked young girl running in terror towards us, crying and screaming away from the fires behind her. The boy in the hospital room with his brother and their frightened mother. He's been blinded. His face is scarred. Am I ugly now, mother? He says. We see the pictures of the headless body dumped out inside the road in a ditch. We've seen the soldier, the black and stiff and grotesque thing that once was a man. We've watched the horror of the human figures leaping out of windows of burning towers. And so we know the satisfaction of hate. We know the sweet joy of revenge, how it feels good to get even. Oh, that was such a nice idea Jesus had. That was a pretty notion. But you can't love people who do evil. It's neither sensible nor practical. It's not wise to the world to love people who do such terrible things. There is no way on earth we can love our enemies. They'll only do wickedness and hatefulness again. And worse, they'll think that they can get away with their wickedness and evil because they think that we are weak and afraid. What would the world come to? But I want to say to you on this hot July day in Holt, what if Jesus wasn't kidding? What if he wasn't talking about some never-never land? What if he really did mean what he said 2,000 years ago? What if he was thoroughly wise to the world and knew firsthand the cruelty and wickedness and evil and hate, knew it all so well from firsthand personal experience? And what if, in spite of all of that, he knew, he still said, love your enemies, turn your cheek, pray for those who misuse you? What if he meant every word of what he said? What then would the world come to? And what if we tried it? What if we said to our enemies, we are the most powerful nation on the earth. We can destroy you. We can kill your children. We can make ruins of your cities and villages. And when we're finished, we won't even know how to look. You won't even know how to look for the places that you used to live in. We have the power to take away your water and scorch your earth, to rob you of the very fundamentals of life. We can change the actual day into actual night. We can do all these things to you and more. But what if we say, listen, instead of those things, we're going to give willingly and generously to you. We're going to spend our great American national treasure and the will and the human lives that we would have spent on destruction, and instead we are going to turn them towards creation. We will mend your roads and highways, expand your schools, modernize your wells and water supplies, save your ancient artifacts and art and culture, preserve your temples and mosques. In fact, we are going to love you. And again we say, no matter what has gone before, no matter what you've done, we are going to love you. We have set our hearts on it. We will treat you like brothers and sisters. We are going to turn our collective national cheek and present it to be stricken the second time, if need be, and offer it to you. Listen, we. But then he was abrupted and halted. Someone out of the congregation was talking. Are you crazy? You must be insane. A man's voice, deep-throated, angry, loud, coming from over the west side of the sanctuary near the windows. What's wrong with you? Are you out of your mind? He stood up, a tall man in a light summer suit, staring at Lyle. You must be out of your crazy, hellish mind. He turned fiercely and grabbed his wife's hand, pulled her to her feet, and gesturing angrily at their little boy, they came out of the pew and went hurrying back up the aisle, through the doors, and out of the church. The congregation watched them leave. Then they began to look around at one another, and then again they looked at Lyle. What do the rest of you think? He said. What do you say? He was standing next to the pulpit now. I'm not afraid to say, a man said. You're a damn terrorist sympathizer. He rose up in the middle of the sanctuary, holding on to the pew back ahead of him, a biggish, heavy set man. What do the rest of you think? What do you say? On September the 6th, 2018, an off-duty white Dallas Police Department patrol officer, Amber Goyer, entered the Dallas, Texas apartment of Botham Jean and fatally shot him. Botham Jean was a 26-year-old black man. He was from Hardington University, and he was an accountant at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Geiger said during the trial that she had entered the apartment believing that it was her own and that she'd shot Jean believing that he was a burglar.
The fact that Gaia was a white police officer who shot and killed Jean, an unarmed black man who was sat on his own sofa in his own house, and was initially only charged with manslaughter, resulted in protests and accusations of racial bias. On October the 1st, 2019, Gaia was found guilty of murder, not manslaughter. The next day, she received a sentence of 10 years in prison. Botham has a younger brother. His name is Brant. He's 18. He asked to speak at the courthouse when the woman was given her 10-year sentence. The brother in court said these words.
I don't want to say twice or for the 100th time what you've or how much you've taken from us. I think you know that. But I just, I hope you go to God with all the guilt, all the bad things you may have done in the past. Each and every one of us may have done something that we're not supposed to do. If you truly are sorry, I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you. And I know if you go to God and ask Him, He will forgive you. And I don't think anyone could say it. Again, I'm speaking for myself, not even behalf of my family. But I love you just like anyone else. And I'm not gonna say I hope you rot and die just like my brother did, but I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't gonna ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you. Because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be give your life to Christ. I'm not going to say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do. Again, I love you as a person. And I don't wish anything bad on you. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
We sang an amazing hymn at the 9 o'clock that ended with these words. You, Creator God, have written your great name on humankind. For our growing in your likeness, bring the life of Christ to mind. That by our response and our service, earth its destiny may find. So what do the rest of you think? What do you say? Amen.